So this is about compressibility of NP-instances and cryptographic applications. It's joint work with Moni Nao. And really, I was supposed to talk on Friday and alone.
So in fact, he's early.
Alon asked, can you switch for whatever reason? I said, no problem. And then I looked at the schedule. I see this is like, this was intended to be the Universal Composability Day. This is really, you look at the talks one after the other. Oh, John is also to blame, it's so this was supposed to be the UC day, and then I come and I bring my compressibility. So I want to actually talk about the UC framework and really show you why this talk is very relevant or where it fits in the framework. So here's my take of the UC framework. This is the UC framework. And where do we fit? Well, we're going to give the talk here. Okay. Let's do this again for Yuval. We're going to give the talk here. Also why this talk fits in the whole title of the workshop. Otherwise, I won't give other connections to this workshop itself. Okay, so to our problem. Really looking at this problem. Is it possible to have an efficient polynomial time procedure that does the following? It gets its input, a formula phi, a CNF formula, and it outputs another CNF formula psi. This is easy. We want two properties. Psi maintains the satisfiability of the formula. It's satisfied if and only if phi is. This is the general reduction from psi to itself. And we also want, like in the picture, psi will be shorter than phi. So is this possible or is it not possible? A quick answer, generally, well, no. And unless you some really neat things happen, because you can just keep on kind of compressing it until you can actually solve it and you can solve the problem in polynomial time. So it doesn't really throw us off because we're not really interested in this general case. We're interested in a very specific case, and this is the case. We're trying to deal with NP languages that have relatively short witnesses. So I'll be more precise. Let's look at two parameters, M and N. M is the number of clauses, and N is the number of variables involved. And so we are looking in the cases where M is much larger than N. The size of the formula itself, this, is much larger than the number of the witness size itself. And now the thing is, okay, you can compress until you get to M, which is relatively close to N, and then there's no hope of doing anything anymore, and at least we will not get this case. So now it's a plausible question, and really, can you get this or not? We call such a compression algorithm a compression of SAT instances. So now the next question is why should we look at this at all? So here's some motivation. If it is possible, we're going to get the following. We're going to get a construction of collision-resistant hash functions from any one-way functions. This would be extremely interesting. If it's impossible, then this gives hope for, efficient, everlasting security in the hybrid bounded storage model. I'll mention what hope for is, and I'll mention what the whole thing is. And also other things, the randomization of sampling, what we call the Nishai, and forward secure storage in Zimbowski, both in subsequent works.
These are hopeful?
Hopeful is the short answer. So this is a kind of an intro to the whole thing. Let's say what I prepared to do in my 50 minutes. I defined this more precisely, the notion of compression generally. Then I'll get to our applications. The one positive one where I'll do most of the talking about, and the negative one. And then I'll say a bit of what we actually know about compression, what can be done. I'll show an example of something that can be done, and a bit of a study here, and some further issues, and that's it. Okay, so let's go for a definition. So really, a bit philosophically speaking here, when you have a hard problem, what can you do with it? It's NP-hard, whatever, you cannot hope to solve it, you can try to approximate it, you can try to solve it on average. There are a bunch of things that you can try to do, and we're saying something actually completely different. Don't solve it, compress it. We're not trying to solve this thing. We're only trying to get it a bit smaller. Maybe someday in the future we'll be able to solve this. But we want to maintain the solution with the more succinct representation. That's the whole goal here. And really this differs from the general notion of compression that is out there that says, okay, whatever you put in the compression algorithm, you should get out. We are not looking for preserving the input. We're looking for preserving the answer, actually. This is answer preserving.
What does it mean to preserve the input?
So preserve the input means I have a problem, I compress it. You use zip, you just compress it down, and then you unzip it, you get back whatever you put inside. We're not looking at getting back. You're not supposed to be able to get back what you put inside. So really the answer thing could be much shorter than the input. Information theoretically you can do much better.
You preserve in just the yes-no or the actual assignment?
So okay, you can preserve the yes-no, which is one bit. You can preserve the assignment, which is relatively short. Answers could be short. 42 is a very short answer. You don't know what the question was. So you don't really look to get the question back here. And really, you should think of this as, okay, suppose P doesn't equal NP, then of course you have compression. You just solve the problem and save the solution. That's it. So that would be answer-preserving compression if P equals NP.
So are you supposed to save all the answers?
So that's a good question, and we can show that you cannot save all the answers for all the problems using compression, but that's really, I'm just saying, so save one answer. Or if you want decision problems, save the bit, that's
but,
it.
But I don't get what it means to save the answer. Because, okay, now I know.
Information, theoretically, it exists in the compressed instance, okay? If you're given unbounded time, after that you can extract this answer.
Because when you were describing it before and you were saying, okay, I'm taking the formula, and let's say it has, I don't know, what was it?
N clauses and then variables, yeah.
Yeah, so let's say it had x1 and x1. I can understand that you can compress this to single x1.
Yeah.
And then you're keeping something shorter, but still it gives information about the original question.
Of course it does.
But if you go to just keeping the answer, then there's no information about the original question.
Okay, so this is really what I'm saying here. We're not looking to keep information about the original question, and therefore all kinds of information theoretic
this
bounds of compression.
Why is the answer interesting? Only the answer.
So we're going to show you the application.
No. I see that it's interesting to try and compress the problem in order to be able maybe to derive a solution. But to compress it all the way to the answer is somewhat weird.
So we're not looking to compress it to the answer. I was just saying, if P equals NP, this is a compression. We're looking to find some other formula that has the same satisfiability.
Right.
So
this
information theoretically, we maintain the answer. Maybe the decompression here would be some unbounded procedure that can solve the compressed problem and then derive the original answer. But you're not supposed to have information theoretically the ability to derive the original formula you had out of.
What do you mean by preserving the answer? So
what
do you mean by that there exists an extraction algorithm that given the compressed equation, what was the answer?
So generally, yes. I'm going to give a more stringent definition right up that doesn't talk about extraction or something. And you can generalize it to really having some extraction. But I'll give the problem. For starters, I will only talk about decision problems throughout the talk, so you can forget about the whole saving the witness or whatever. Unless I
say then either 0 or 1, like one of them is a good compression of any formula. For any formula, either 0 or 1 is a good compression. We just don't know which one.
Yes, we don't know which one. Exactly.
Okay. So didn't we solve it even without P being yet? Oh, because we might have the wrong answer.
Yeah. Okay. Small caveat. So back to the definition. We're talking about, in general, NP languages that have short witnesses. And throughout, M is going to be the bigger one, the instance length. N is going to be the witness, and M is much larger than the witness.
Was it N before the number of variables?
It was, but now we're talking about general NP languages, not necessarily SAT. Or another way of stating this is that for every X of length M, if it is in the language, then it has a short witness. Okay?
So I'll
touch on that in a minute. Okay, here's the definition. So the compression of a language L is an efficient algorithm, Z, and a polynomial P, and another language, L prime, such that for every X of length M, we have the two properties. One is ZX maps instances from L to instances from L prime, and instances out of L to instances out of L prime. So this is maintaining the solution. And we want that it will be shorter. And by shorter, we mean smaller than a polynomial of N and log M. So this quantity is really dominated by the witness lengths, by N rather than the instance length. So potentially, for large enough M, this is going to be smaller than the original instance. That should kind of answer you. I'm really interested in any case where this is going to be shorter than the original. So you can think of N as polylog. Another way to think about it is the following. In our applications, what we'll have is M is any general polynomial in N, and P is a fixed in advance polynomial in N. So you can look at any polynomial size formula, but we want to shrink it down to something of size n to the third, for instance.
And in this example, L and L prime are the same?
In the original example, L and L prime are the same. This doesn't necessarily have to hold. And really, so about this, you can think of the problem of how about 3SAT? Is 3SAT an interesting question for compression? 3SAT means any clause has only three literals, so you have at most n to the third that clauses altogether, and this is already bounded by a fixed polynomial in M. So the general SAT is very interesting. 3SAT, we already considered it as compressed in advance, so we're not talking about languages of that sort. Another way of saying it is, in 3SAT, M is not much larger than N.
For example, compressing from a general formula to a 3SAT formula would be great.
Yeah,
it
would be
great,
yes.
As long as they don't add too many variables.
Yeah, but you can't add variables freely, that's it.
Right.
So is that it for the... So I just say one note. Why is this polynomial in N and log M? Well, it can be relaxed. You don't really need log M, you need something that is smaller than any polynomial in M, and log M will fit that. And just for convenience, we use that. And in general, when applications come up, I'll show you what we really need this P to be.
So you don't say anything about the witness length of the new compressed language? It could be bigger than the original.
No, I don't say anything. It could be bigger, and I'm fine with that. Okay. So to our applications, why is this interesting? Here we go. We'll start with collision-resistant hash functions. So just a quick introduction. These are families of hash functions. Well, each one is a length reducing function, and therefore they have collisions in them. So a collision is two distinct points that map to the same point. And we say that the function is a family is collision-resistant hash if an efficient algorithm cannot find a collision for a random h out of the family. And these are very important. They have a wide range of applications. I wrote down signatures, strong commitments, and low communication protocols. This would, for example, give the statistically hiding bit commitments without interaction or one round of interaction, which would be really something to aim for. So that's motivation, and this is more motivation. This is for a general audience. Constructing these are really central problem, and I'll note that. Well, I'm a bit shaky on this, but there have been several new attacks on the collision-resistant hash functions used in practice, the SHA-1 and MD5, which make these questions a bit more interesting. To me, it's do these attacks work only on collision resistance and not on one-way function? This is kind of highlights the difference between one-wayness and collision resistance. So what's the state with one-wayness and collision resistance? Well, I won't introduce one-way functions, but there's no known construction. And moreover, Simon showed in 98 that there is no black box constructions from collision-resistant hash functions, from one-way functions to collision-resistant hash functions. Okay, so whatever I'll do now, I'm going to show that if SAT is compressible, then there exists a construction of collision-resistant hash functions from any one-way function. Due to Simon's impossibility, you should expect that this would be non-black box, and indeed it could. So let's sketch this construction. We take an input to the hash function, which is a long string x of length m. And okay, now we need to generate a family of hash functions. How do we describe each of these? Each of these is going to be described by a commitment s to some index in this long string. What are commitments? Well, the digital analog of locked boxes. It's a box that in a commit phase, a sender kind of puts inside this index I, closes it, shuts it down, and sends to the receiver. So the receiver actually gets a string that hides inside it this value I. And there's a reveal phase where the sender sends a key over to the receiver. And the receiver can actually verify that indeed inside the string S, what was hidden was this value I. And what do we mean by verify? Well, think of it, he has a circuit that takes the string S, the index I hidden inside, and the key, and this verification algorithm will output 1 if and only if this was indeed correct. And of course, these can be built based on one-way functions, and this is going to be our connection to one-way functions. So we're actually starting with commitment rather than one-way functions, and we will get the eventual result. Okay, so what do we do with the commitment S that we have there? We're going to define the CNF formula phi of S and the long string X to be one that has the property that this phi is satisfiable if and only if X in the I's position is 1.
What is I
is the value hidden inside S. Okay, so it's hidden in here. It's there. And really the point is you
what does it mean that the formula Oh, you're defining the formula based also on the commitment.
Based on the commitment and X, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and... Okay, and now... So how do I go about doing this? What I'll do is I'll define for each I, for each location, each J, each location here, I'm going to define a circuit that is satisfiable if and only if, well, S is a commitment to the value J, and X in the J's position equals 1.
So the assignment is a randomness used for commitment, or?
The assignment...
I mean, for the circuit, what are the inputs for the circuit?
Okay, so what do I put in here? Maybe I'll just state this. The fact that we can actually generate this circuit without knowing the value I inside the commitment. And how is it done? You take the verification algorithm, and you fix. Well, what do we fix? First of all, we're going to say we're looking at the value J. So if xj equals 0, then nothing. The circuit always outputs 0. But if xj equals 1, then we take the verification circuit, we fix the value j, we fix s, the input, and all we leave alive there is the randomness of the commitment, the key, actually. So this is going to be a circuit where the inputs are the key, the secret key, and if there is a key that actually opens the commitment to J,
then
it's
some random S?
So, yeah, there's going to be, it's not a random S, it's generated
it's
as a commitment.
So you choose one of the commitments for each location where xi equals 1,
yeah.
You generate a random key and you generate a random commitment.
No. Okay.
You say for every commitment S.
Yes. For every commitment S, you get this circuit.
But S is not.
Okay. So think of the general setting of collision-resistant hash functions. You are given a key from somewhere. I'm hiding here a really crucial fact that there is some secret information in generating this key. You cannot just generated from scratch. There's a paper by Leo and Chunyan that says that actually there's a difference between these two models. So the key here, the key of the hash function, this commitment has some hidden information.
Function,
yeah.
S is the key of the hash function.
Yes.
I
use key for another place, but S is the key of H. Of hash function.
But what I don't understand is how can this S be open?
It's not open. That's the whole thing. I can generate this without opening.
The hash function has exactly m hash. The family has exactly m hash functions. One for each.
For each I, you can generate a random commitment.
Many.
So there
would
be
many
commitments.
Yes. Yes. So the family is huge. I need perfect binding. A statistical binding will work. So
one-way function.
Yeah, one-way function works. The Naur scheme works. Okay. So I'll just repeat this. How do I generate this? If xj equals 1, what I'll do is I'll take the verification circuit, fix the input J, fix the commitment S, and all I have left is this randomness, the random key that opens S. And the thing is, there is only one opening to this thing, and it would be satisfiable if and only if there exists some key that actually satisfies the signal.
By key, you mean decommitment?
Decommitment key, yeah. So I used key twice here. So key is the commitment key.
So the null commitment is interactive for all the function. So how do you...
Not really, actually. I mean, okay.
It is interactive.
It's public key. So you assume the commitment is
Yeah.
No, you can do
you can do this if you're not malicious when you generate the key, then you're fine. If you actually look at who's really trying to make this collision-resistant scheme secure, it's the guy who chooses H. He has every incentive to make this binding. Okay. Okay. So we have these circuits. Now I was trying to get this huge formula. So what we'll do next is take an OR of all these circuits for every J. Now, for every J that is not equal to the original I that's hidden in there, this is going to be zero. This circuit would be unsatisfiable. Only in one place it may be satisfiable, and that only happens when XI equals 1. So the output of this big circuit is actually satisfiable if and only if X in the I's position, where I is whatever is hidden inside S, is 1. And so this is what I said here. And all we need now is some standard techniques dating back to Cook's theorem that will get me a formula, seen a formula out of this. And really, it's important to look at the details here. What we can get is a formula of length n times poly n.
What is
okay. N is the number, n is the security parameter of the commitment. That's the number, actually, that's the number of variables that are left open here. Okay, and there are not going to be too many.
That's the length of the key you need to open the commitment.
Yes. So this is the security parameter of the key to the commitment. And so the formula is of length n times poly n. It doesn't grow too much. And the number of variables does not grow too much either. So
it's
a
problem.
Yes.
You don't need to.
Right. Well, you need to add a few to get it down to a formula. That's it. Okay. Now let's build a hash function out of it. Unless you.
Formula, you mean binary formula for what the inputs are, the decommitment bits?
Yeah. The decommitment bits, and they're satisfied. This formula is satisfied if and only if X in the I's position was 1. That's it. Okay, so now let's go to the compression algorithm. We have a compression algorithm for SAT, which is denoted by Z, and I want to build a hash function. I promised a collision-resistant hash function. So what we do is this. Here is the hash function. It has a key S, and we're given an input X. You do the following. You generate, given S and X, the formula phi of S of X that has this property that we talked about, and you simply compress this formula. That's it. So from here on, it's pretty easy. Well, first of all, it is indeed shrinking because of the compression. If the compression is good enough, this will be shorter than M, the input. And why is this true? And some acknowledgement to the inspiration from Yuval, Eyal, and Rafi. So suppose we can find a collision. What would that mean? So we find two X's that hash down to the same spot. Now, because of the correctness of the compression, what we will get eventually is that X in the I's position must equal X prime in the I's position. Okay, but we do look at these two strings and they're different. So there is some location J where they're not the same. And we can deduce immediately that I, the hidden value, is not equal to this J. Okay, so we have two strings, we look at the place they're different, and we can say something about the value I hidden in the commitment, and this really breaks the semantic security of the commitment, and that's it. So finding a collision would mean breaking the security of the commitment scheme, and we have the reduction we want.
You can probably find collisions with probably D1 over M.
No.
You know if you found a collision or not, so it's not. Once you found it.
Once you found it, that's it. Then you break the commitment. No, it works. If this dead introduces errors, then you are going to get into trouble. But I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so some notes on this. Well, who do we need to compress here? I said that, but there are others. Click would suffice also. I'll mention more about this towards the end. And in general, any or of many short sat instances, something that we will eventually call VCR, but that's for the future. Any such language, if this any such sort of thing, if it's compressible, then we're okay. How much to compress? Well, we said it's enough to compress from m times poly m to m minus 1. This will give you an indication that you don't need to compress a lot here. But just an anecdote, the compressed problem is never actually solved here. We don't really need to solve it at the end. We just needed this to get some binding property. Okay.
It's not for the binding, it's
for the function to be collision resistant. It can be shrinking.
Right?
So we need both things. We need both shrinking and the fact that you maintain the solution, but you don't actually need to extract the solution at any time.
Right, but it seems to me it's only for the shrinking, otherwise you can just use it as it is without shrinking. But it would be a fine collision resistant function.
Okay. I mean, you can't do with any one part of the properties of compression. Okay, so next application, totally different direction. What is everlasting security? So everlasting security comes from really this annoying thing that computationally based encryption typically leaves a fingerprint behind. That you can, so you encrypt something. Let's look just at encryption. The encryption will always remain there. If you can break it by a computationally unbound adversary, you can always break it in the future. Okay. And this is not good because maybe in the future we'll find some better technologies, that's quantum, that we can find algorithms for factoring, or there's simply lots of time in the future. Just keep on running. Eventually, you know, something good will happen. So everlasting security is a notion that was introduced to kind of get around this, saying, well, if it's not broken now, online, in this setting that we're talking about, you'll never be able to get the information out of it. And this cannot be done in any setting, but you need to look at the setting. Specifically, the term was introduced in the paper by Armanding and Rabin in the setting of a bounded storage model. Well, the adversary really cannot remember anything, everything. And this is crucial because you cannot hope to do anything if you remember the whole fingerprint. But if you don't remember everything that happened there, then there's hope for everlasting security. And the claim that we'll show is that incompressibility is actually essential for achieving efficiency in this setting. I'll be much more exact now. So. There are two settings we talk about in the bounded storage model. Either the parties share a secret in advance, where many works were done, and they have very efficient encryption there in just about any parameter that you want. And then there's a setting where no key is shared in advance, and the parties there really need high memory requirements. It's a square root of whatever the adversary remembers, and this is too much, and there's been an effort to try and get things better. Well, it was shown that you can't do better by Zimbowski and Maurer. So here's a suggestion that was raised in a couple of places throughout. Let's try and get this hybrid model Well, we are going to have a temporary bound on the running time and use this to exchange the initial key. So if we don't have a key, we're in trouble, but if we have it, then we're fine. So let's exchange a key computationally and then run one of these very efficient protocols. And the point is that once this protocol is over, if you didn't break the key initially, then you're dead. And this was the hope. It was shown by Zimbowski and Maurer that actually this rationale does not go through as is. They showed that there exists a hybrid scheme made with two secure components. One, a computational key agreement, and one is one of these very efficient schemes. And both are secure separately, but when you do the hybrid together, the whole scheme is totally insecure. This was for some natural unnatural occurrences of these, but the definition still held true. And what we really show is something that is that says this is not a coincidence. Well, if SAT is compressible, then this hybrid bounded storage model is no more powerful than the standard bounded storage model. There is actually, you gain almost nothing from putting any computational bound at some point. So in a sense, all efficient schemes in this setting are insecure. And a way of putting this, maybe this puts the whole issue of compressibility even more to the front than the collision resistance has, because what it says is you cannot avoid it. If you want everlasting security and you want some sort of efficiency there, then there's no ignoring the issue of compressibility. You should either assume incompressibility or prove incompressibility of many interesting functions. Languages, yeah.
I'm just wondering about this thing. Isn't there some kind of gap, like a gap between negligible and non-negligible? There is like an intermediate case, which is, because I mean, your theorem that you put there said if it's like always compressible, then there is no hope, so it must be incompressible. So maybe it's like...
if I had a very nice and clean incompressibility statement, I would have put it up there. If this and this is incompressible, but there's really a gap between what you can do. I mean, if you can compress with a polynomial probability of success, that would be enough to make the scheme insecure. So that's not really the definition that I gave before, but there's always a gap here between what is polynomial on the one hand or negligible.
So you cannot like state something clean with directly incompressibility, I mean, because
of no, and also not for a general language like SAT, but for the specific language that will come out of these arguments. That is.
Because it looks like so far, both of you think, they just said if something is compressible, then something is, well, proof also, whatever. So I'm just, because it's, well, I don't know, I guess. It's just kind of curious that both of your orthogonal things start with the same preamble.
Okay, generally, you can get this. If you have this compression, then you get both insecurity and the collision resistance. Okay, that would be a way of stating it, but you can get the insecurity with compressing far less.
What does many mean?
Many. I'll have a slide.
Lots.
No, not a whole class of languages here. A whole class of languages here, and I'll have to, I'll get to what is compressible and what isn't in a while.
Including
yeah.
SAT? You remember that you
yes,
have
I remember, I remember, yeah.
Including SAT.
Including SAT,
you
of
can
course.
Have your 10 minutes back.
No, SAT is, you already have this from the statement, but including SAT, CLIC, many others. Okay. So now let's say. What?
Talk overview? We're 40 minutes into this.
Okay, I didn't expect all these questions. It's not.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
This was the
yeah,
I just
yeah.
finished the 20-minute talk from my from Star.
Okay.
From Fox. Okay. So this was the first 20 minutes. Let's go to. So what can be compressible? I'm talking about this. Can something be compressed? Well, yes. Vertex cover can. I'll show an example.
But this is not a problem for the hybrid model. This is not one
no,
of the
no,
things
no.
that
No, no,
what
defines
the set of problems that need to be compressed or not compressed?
In a couple of slides, yeah.
Okay, so I don't know what to ask, but I don't know whether you're going back down to the model or not.
And no, I'm not going back. So,
okay. So I guess, I mean, what I'm trying to understand, so if I came out of a hybrid BSM scheme using RSA, then you would show that RSA is compressible or incompressible.
That RSA, some language related to RSA is incompressible. Yeah, that would be the meaning, yeah.
What does it mean that RSA is compressible at all?
Some language related to RSA, I didn't say...
Many
languages.
Many
languages. Yeah,
many.
Yeah, but okay. So what is vertex cover? We have the graph of size m, this is the instance size, the number of edges, and is there a small set of size n of vertices that touch all edges? And we want to show that this is compressible. So here's a very simple compression algorithm. It does the following. Let's look at the graph. And first what we'll do is we'll remove all the heavy edges. All the heavy vertices, those that have a large number of neighbors. So let's look at this red guy. He has many neighbors. Let's remove him. So as long as the degree is larger than n, we remove him. Why is that? Because anyone who has degree larger than n must be in the vertex cover. Otherwise, all his neighbors are in the vertex cover. That's already more than n.
N is the upper bound on the size.
N is the size of the vertex cover we're looking at.
Not the number of vertices.
No. So n is the number of is the vertex cover we're trying to find. So we remove these, and now what do we have left? So first of all, we remember how many we had.
Does the compress mean, in some sense, remove all the things that you know? For example, if it's a formula and it's x1 and...
Definitely that's a good idea to do, to start with. But it's not going to get you very far.
In that sense, isn't everything compressible? Oh, but maybe you'd introduce it enough in size to satisfy your requirement.
Yeah. And what happens if you don't have anything redundant? What do you remove then? Back to our thing. We removed all the heavy vertices. Now what do we have? Let's look at the graph. If it has less than or equal to n square edges, we store it. Otherwise, we say no vertex cover. There was no vertex cover. And the new instance is this new one. It has size n squared. And the new vertex cover we're looking for is of size n minus k, the number of removed vertices. So why is this true? Well, first of all, we removed only guys that were in the small vertex cover that was there. What I'll show is that if a cover existed in the original one, a cover of size n, then g prime has no more than n squared vertices. And this is very, very simple. Every edge in the new one is covered by one of n vertices. This is due to the cover being there. But because we removed all the heavy one, then every vertex has degree at most n. So you just say all the edges are covered by n vertices, each one covers at most n, do the math, you have at most n square edges in the graph. So this is really fairly simple. What do we really learn from this? I'd say not much. Well, we learned some interesting language have non-trivial compression, and really the thing is vertex cover has this small kernel where all the hardness is in. So vertex cover, if it's of length n, if the vertex cover size is n, then you cannot have a huge graph that does not have a lot of redundant information. If you have such a graph, you can remove the redundant information, go down to a small kernel or core that has all the hardness in it, and you're fine. And this is really related to parameterized complexity. algorithms for parameterized complexity algorithms for vertex cover work this way. They call this the kernelization method. But it's not totally related, because not every one of these kernelization algorithms will give you compression, and not every compression will give you kernelization. So they're close, but not really the same thing. Yeah.
First, what do you mean by non-trivial compression as opposed to yes trivial compression?
Well, actually, this algorithm was pretty trivial. but non-trivial is okay. If I ask you, what would your question be? Answer me. Non-trivial meaning trivial is 3-sat. That's a trivial compression. You don't touch it. Okay. Here you have to work.
So my other question is: do you think it's related to it having a very good approximation factor?
I don't think so, not directly, but I really touch on this in the next two slides.
So you have a language that does have a good approximation, but still is not compressible, or you don't know.
So what is good approximation? Take SAT. You can approximate it to factor 2, but I don't know. Does it help me? In Click, you cannot approximate it at all, but. Essentially, what you'll see soon is that, for instance, SAT is as hard to compress as Click. So I don't see a relation.
Take log of the maximum number of satisfied variables. This is approximatable to within one. It's just it's the wrong scale, right?
Does
it help you if you can compress the network?
It helps well for some instances. For the bounded storage thing, it will help me, of course. It will be interesting. What I want to get out of this is that compressing one NP complete problem does not compress all of NP. This is clear by this example, because we have nothing to say about SAT, and we have about compression of vertex cover. Even languages that are very related to vertex cover, the reduction from vertex cover to Click or dominating set is almost non-existent. Still, we have no compression for these. And the reason is that the carb reductions we use for deriving these NP-completeness things can really blow up the length of the witness to M rather than to N. And then the compression doesn't help us anymore. The M greater than N does not hold anymore. So we have a complexity study. You can go to the paper and look at most details. What we want to say is kind of, we're trying to understand what is easy to compress and what is hard, and it really requires a new classification. The key to the classification is the reduction that we use, that we call a W reduction, that limits the growth of the witness. And using this reduction, we get a new hierarchy of classes with respect to this compression. We call it the VC classification. This stands for verification complexity. You can hold all the jokes on the bad choice of letters, whatever. We'll do that. We'll take that offline.
Can you tell us what's bad about VC?
Fapnik, whatever, and there's at least two other occurrences of VC. Here's the classification. I'm throwing this map at you that has, well, these are the names of the classes, and these are languages that sit in here. VC0 is the compressible language. Yes, anything that we know that is compressible, there's a list here of some. VCO is very interesting, potentially the easiest one to compress. So it goes like, if you can compress VC, you can compress everything. If you can compress the VC3, you can compress everything from here down, from here up, actually. So it will all collapse down to VC0. The cryptographic applications sit in potentially the easiest class to compress.
How do you compress PRG output? It's probabilistic.
It's probabilistic. Just hash. Okay, so I gave you just a quick look, and in the small bell. Do I have time?
Can continue.
Yes, I can continue. So further issues, we show compression for other languages using all kinds of techniques, pretty simple. We don't learn much from these to the general case. We talk about search and decision, and those two bullets here. We had an attempt to get Minikrypt equals Cryptomania, this nice thing via compression. It has not worked through. I depends on how much time I have, if I'll show you that or not. And some approaches to compression. So there's a long list of stuff in the paper, and these are the ones that have the nicest buzzwords, so I put them up to get you to look at it. These are the only ones that I really want to touch. So I'll just mention this property that we added. We call it witness retrievability, and we say this. We have an instance X that has a witness WX. Now we compress it, so we get a new instance Y that has a different witness WY. Now, definitely, if you are given X and WX, it makes sense that you can find the witness WY. But what happens if you don't get the original X? You only get the compressed version Y and the original witness to X. Can you get the witness to Y from this? If you can do this efficiently, we call this a witness retrievable compression. And the statement was, still is, this holds. If there exists a witness retrievable compression of SAT, then Minikrypt equals Cryptomania. This is the terms of Impagliazzo to saying that oblivious transfer and actually peer protocols can be constructed from any one-way function. This would be very nice. OT is important, blah, blah. And of course, there's the Impagliazzo-Rudig separation that says you cannot do this in a black box manner, and it is not a black box manner.
Is the theorem in the paper, or is it an unpublished result?
It's in the paper.
So this theorem assumes that both players are phenomenally bounded, right? Because if one player is infinitely powerful, you can actually guarantee from
Yes. So this statement actually holds with unbounded receiver, you get OT from one-way function given compression of SAT without witness retrievability.
No, unbounded receiver, you can get OT from any one-way function. Is that so?
Is that true?
But you need p-space computation for one of the players.
Okay.
But if both players are phenomenally bounded, then I think that that's cool. So I'm confused what you're saying.
Again,
I thought, well, didn't Zimbowski exactly construct unbounded OT from one-way function based on this? So I'm just surprised.
No, but you need a p-space.
No. Zimbowski said, well, if this does not work, then you can build unbounded OT using one-way permutation.
He's saying that you can do it anyway, so I'm just surprised.
So I'm not sure about your claim, Rafi.
So it's in the old OUI paper from the people cited, you can do it, but you need a B-space player.
Okay,
but for polynomial, their result holds for polynomial time players. I'm not sure how they actually, I never understood their result if the players are not polynomial.
So we'll take it offline, I'm not. Just to kind of cool the enthusiasm about this, we have a statement that says that if one-way functions exist, then there is no witness retrievable compression of SAT. What? The two things together mean that, I'll just say, this approach is not going to work. We're not going to be able to prove the if here. I said this statement is still true, but we're not going to get anything out of it because we can't prove this. Still, if we look at the specific language that is generated throughout the reduction, this we cannot rule out, its compression. So we don't have a statement for a nice general language like SAT or CLIC. We have one for not nice language, but this kind of puts a damper on the whole witness retrievability approach. We also, I mentioned this holds also for a unique set. If there's only a unique witness, still you cannot do a witness retrievability. That requires a bit more work.
The
impossibility, yeah. So both of them hold for unique set. So that's why that was an attempt to try and bridge, an approach. So this is my final point. Well, gaps set and some speculation here. Let's look at a promise problem that we call gap set. It takes a CNF formula, and we have the guarantee that it's either satisfiable or it's really any assignment satisfies at most one minus some polynomial fraction of the clauses. Suppose we had this thing, then we actually have compression for this. Choose a random subset of the clauses, and this is going to work with very high probability. It will maintain the satisfiability of the original formula. So this is very simple, and here's a good idea. Let's take instances of SAT, run the PCP theorem, generate, this is what the PCP theorem does, it kind of builds up gaps, generate a gap SAT instance, and now compress it. So where does this fail? The problem is really that the PCP reduction creates many new variables. And the challenge here is to generate a new PCP theorem that does not add many new variables to it. I'll just say that just about any step in the known PCP theorems add a substantial number of variables to them. Just starting, really every step you look at adds variables, and it looks like, it's an approach, but it's going to require some new techniques.
But the goal of PCP machine is to get K-SAT for constant K.
Yeah, just getting for constant K, going to constant K here will add a lot of variables. I mean, take an instance of SAT,
so
go to 3-SAT, you add n variables on the way. Already there, you're dead. But you can formulate a PCP that starts not with a 3-SAT, but a general SAT. The fact that...
I mean, the purpose of the machinery is to create instances with bonded width, so you have to change the machine.
Yeah. Okay, so let's skip this slide. Moni already did it in the previous workshop, got him into trouble. Really, let's just sum up this. This looks like really, we have many interesting applications, and we feel this topic is something you cannot ignore altogether, and there's many open problems like who is compressible and who is not, and what other applications do we get. For example, this recent work by Yael and Ran on short Nidec proofs will be almost trivial with compression, but you also get the hierarchy that we had here really applies to what they can do and cannot do here. So there's a connection. And there's subsequent works of Dubrovin, Ishai, and Zimbovsky that also touch this notion of compression. And really, this is just the beginning.